if you're stuck inside of a building, a lot of times you don't have proper molecular filtration or good ventilation. You know, and you're tired throughout the day, it's not because you were streaming your Netflix show on repeat. A lot of times it can be the chemicals that are inside your space.
Hello there and welcome to Let's Talk Clean Air, our regular look at how clean air can affect the quality process for you and the workplace. On this episode, we're finding out about odors, gases and toxins in the air and how to deal with them. My name is Dusty Rhodes, and joining me to explain more about this is Trent Thiel from Camphill USA. Trent is an industry expert and an educator for molecular filtration. And with over 150 million registered chemicals in the world, that is quite an area that he covers. So let's get in and find out more about molecular filtration with Trent. Trent, you're very passionate about this whole area. Tell me why.
Yeah, so it's one of those things that, so I've been with Camphill for about 8 years, and before I came on with them, I was more involved in the industrial process gases, and that's kind of an area that people understand there's industrial gases that are there, and you don't really understand about all the, you know, how all of those gases can actually impact the people, the environment, and other processes and equipment around them, right? So it was one of those things that I didn't really understand until I really got into the business, and then once you understand about how this impacts not only, you know, when you get outside of the industrial aspect of it, you know, we're talking about our families, our children that are in schools, that are in office buildings, things of that nature, and really understanding and being able to educate about how these, we're all familiar with particulate matter, right? We all have particulate filters in our home. We understand particulate matter. It's one of those things that for all intents and purposes, you can touch it. You can see it. Right? With molecular contaminants, it's kind of out of sight and out of mind. And so people don't really pay attention to it until it's a problem. And so for me as an educator, it's really important to make sure that other people have awareness around that and understand how it really does impact our daily lives. And so it's something that I have become passionate about. And it's important, you know, to be passionate about what you do. And that way you can learn more every day. I mean, as you mentioned, there's over 150 million registered chemicals. Well, actually now, Dusty, that was probably from one of my old excerpts that you took from somewhere, but it's actually over 252 million registered chemicals now. And when I first started with Camphill, there was actually only 73 million registered chemicals. So in 8 years, that number is more than tripled. So it's pretty incredible.
And are a lot of these chemicals, I mean, are they all particulates? Are they all molecular? Is it a combination?
Yeah, so it could be a combination. You have a service called Chemical Abstract Services. So every chemical out there has a CAS number, right? When you look at the MSDR, or I guess the safety data sheet now, is what we call them, you can see a CAS number associated with that. And some of them have other CAS numbers associated with them as well, because different chemicals can make up a combination or a new chemical compound, right? So a lot of them are derivations of each other. There's minerals, different polymers, even some salts and things like that, you know, alloys. And a lot of those aren't molecular contaminants because they would be considered particulate. But for the most part, you know, there's over 252 million registered, you know, CAS numbers, I should say, out there.
The first official question I wanted to ask you was, what is an airborne molecular contamination?
Yeah. So what you would have first and foremost, so an airborne molecular contaminant, you have, we're talking about airborne contaminants in general, right? So as I mentioned, you have particulate matter and then you have molecular contaminants. So I always like to start with things that people can wrap their minds around. Again, the particulate matter, right? So you've got, according to, you know, the ISO, you know, not to throw numbers around, but ISO 16890, you've got four different particulate categories. From sizes of particulate, you have coarse particulates, which would be those particulates from 0.3 to 10 microns. You would have PM10, which would be from 0.3 to 10 microns. Then you'd have PM2.5, which is really what we care about from entering our homes and office buildings and schools, which is 0.3 to 2.5 microns. And then you have PM1. Which is 0.3 to 1 microns. And those are the things we care about in healthcare environments and surgical suites, right? When somebody's being operated on, you don't want to have any type of contaminant that could potentially get into that space. And then once you get past that is where HEPA filtration, a true high efficiency particulate arrestants, would come into play, which would be where you get efficiencies of 0.3 micron particulate. And so those are, and so when you get into an airborne molecular contaminant, you're talking about a individual molecule that is actually, could be 100 to 1,000 times smaller than those 0.3 micron particulates we're removing with the HEPA filter.
Okay. So all the numbers that you've been describing so far, you're essentially saying that they're getting smaller and smaller.
100%. Yeah.
So you're talking about stuff that, you know, we're worried about the PM1 is that's what we worry about when people are lying cut open on an operating theater. We need to make sure. But right. What you're concerned with, which is molecular, is 1,000 times smaller.
Can be. Yes, sir. Yeah.
Wow. Right. That's kind of mind blowing. What are the most common contaminants then that we see?
So a lot of questions you're going to ask me, I'm going to say it depends. Will be will answer you because it does, right? It depends on where you are. Because if I'm at, let's say that I'm at a petrochemical refinery, right? Versus if I'm at your daughter's school, the contaminants I care about are going to be completely different, right?
Okay.
So again, what I always like to do is I like to start with things that majority of your listeners would probably gravitate to, which would be what we would consider general indoor air quality, right? IAQ. We hear that term a lot. Stands for indoor air quality. And so when speaking for general IAQ, really what you care about is you have to look at your indoor environment and your external environment. So from the external environment, what you'd really care about are things. There's three primary contaminants that I would say from a chemical standpoint, you should be concerned about. The first would be ozone. So ground level ozone. Ground level ozone is generated from UV light, essentially reacting with exhaust from industrial processes and from vehicles.
Mm-hmm.
So when we talk about clean air vehicles and things like that, the reason we push that so hard is because without a lot of the emissions from these vehicles, you wouldn't be getting that ground level ozone because the UV wouldn't be reacting with any of those chemicals. And the same thing with factories, right? Mm. SO2, so sulfur dioxide that would be coming out of factories also can react with UV light and generate ground level ozone. So when you have things like, and from the cars, you have things like BTECs. You might have heard that acronym before. It stands for benzene, toluene, ethylbenzene, xylene, which are, again, those are the kind of the chemicals that we look at from a TVOC, total VOC standpoint from the exhaust of these vehicles. That's kind of what we look at. And toluene is used as a surrogate gas many times for simulating the impact that vehicle exhaust can have on an environment. So the three things you should be concerned about, again, all those chemicals I just mentioned, you can drum it down to three things, which would be ozone, nitrogen dioxide, and sulfur dioxide. Nitrogen dioxide is primarily going to come from diesel fumes. It's oxides of nitrogen, so you can get some, you know, nitrous oxide, things like that as well, or nitric oxide. But main ones are going to be nitrogen dioxide, NO2. Sulfur dioxide, known as SO2, and then ozone, which is known as O3. And that's from outside air.
Now, I know you're going to say it depends.
Yeah.
But sure. What kind of effects do those nasty things have on us little human beings?
Sure. Yeah. So you've got, the main thing that people identify when they say, oh, I need a molecular filter. Most people think, most people would say, oh, I need a carbon filter, but we can talk about the difference between a carbon filter and a molecular filter here in a couple minutes. But the main contaminant or the main reason people think they need molecular filtration would be odors, smells. But the primary reason people need molecular filtration and may not realize it is for irritants. So ozone and nitrogen dioxide, for example, ozone can have extremely detrimental effects on your lungs. There was a lot of, several years ago, there was a lot of ozone generators inside of buildings, inside of homes. And then we found that, yes, ozone is a very good oxidizer, but it also will turn your lungs to leather. And so it can actually start impacting your lung health and can cause further, those that have respiratory issues, you can have further lung damage. So it's really just protecting your pulmonary tract. Nitrogen dioxide, while it also can impact your lungs, can also impact your brain. It can make you lethargic. Mm. So many times, it can make you lose focus. So if you're stuck inside of a building, a lot of times you don't have proper molecular filtration or better or good ventilation.
Mm.
And you're tired throughout the day. It's not because you were streaming your your Netflix show, you know, on repeat for 8 hours that night. You know, a lot of times it can be the chemicals that are inside your space, which kind of leads me back to what I was going to talk about, the internal contaminants. We talked about 252 million registered chemicals in the world. And you've got, you know, inside of the space, you can have things like cleaning supplies. You can have construction materials, which would have adhesives and different aldehydes and glues that are off-gassing all the time. Even clothing, right? The different dyes and pigments and food. One of the biggest contributors, right? So your indoor environment is always dynamic and changing constantly, depending on what's being brought in, what's being taken out. And so, you know, to say what are the most common contaminants from inside, I wouldn't be able to even venture a guess. You know, I would say it depends on the types of foods you're eating, depends on the construction materials that have been used inside of your space, the cleaning supplies. So I would say irritants, as far as its impact on human beings, irritants are the number one reason people should be putting molecular filtration in, but odors are the number one reason people think they need molecular filtration, because it's really the only identifier that we have.
So we've got the smell, you've got irritants, which can literally irritate you, toxins, which are just poisonous.
Yeah, sure.
I'm sure many of these things as well can also affect the equipment that could be in a facility.
Yeah.
Have you come across that?
Yeah, so there's four. And I should have mentioned toxic gases as well. You know, but I was still thinking about the general IAQ, and typically you're not going to find toxic gases in general IAQ. Many times it's going to be, that's going to be more closely related with in military operations, things of that nature, right? Where, you know, that's where our nuclear applications, where we would have, where you've got different types of radioisotopes you're trying to remove, or I guess in any event, the fourth category would be corrosion control. So you have four reasons people would need molecular filtration: odors, irritants, toxic gases, and corrosion control for the protection of processes and equipment. You know, and that's really why a petrochemical facility would have it. Pulp and paper facility, you know, metal refining for precious metals, microelectronics is probably one of the biggest ones that's out there that has very specific needs for the different types of corrosive chemicals that would impact their processes and product.
Now, I'm not an expert in the area, which is why we have you. When it comes to particulates, I can understand how a filter is able to trap these things and to stop it coming in through the facility.
Sure.
But if molecular is so small,
yeah,
how do you control that with a filter?
Yeah, that's a good question. I don't know. No, I'm kidding. there's two types of mechanisms that you would use to remove a molecular contaminant, which is also important to understand why you need molecular contamination control. So it would be, you know, what is the purpose, right? Is it protection of humans? What are you protecting those humans from? Is it protection of a process or equipment? What are you trying to protect them from? So when you look at all these different chemicals that are out there, Dusty, what you have are these chemicals have a molecular weight, they've got a vapor pressure, and they've got a boiling point. So the lower the molecular weight and the lower the boiling point, and the higher the vapor pressure, makes it tougher to capture, right? So those are really fast molecules, right? They're very volatile. There's other ones that are bigger, slower, right? If you think of a molecule being slow. And so that they would be captured by those ones. 99% of the registered chemicals out there are going to be best removed with physical adsorption. So you have chemical adsorption and physical adsorption. Physical adsorption is the most common. When people say, oh, I need a carbon filter, they're most likely talking about for physical adsorption. So the way that it works is that if you can imagine, you've got kind of a pegboard sitting on your desk there, and all those little peg holes are what in their filtration, in the molecular filtration industry, we call active sites. And so these active sites have intermolecular forces. And it's the same way kind of a spider climbs up the wall. So every single solid surface on planet Earth has intermolecular forces, right? So the molecules that are on the end of a spider's feet our legs, if you will, are weak enough to be attracted by those intermolecular forces. But the spider is strong enough to break those weak bonds and move to wherever it would need to. These molecules aren't looking to break those bonds per se. So what happens is that you have static pressure from a filter, right? So you're forcing that air in through a filter, and then that those contaminants are being pushed through this porous substrate, whether it be a coal type carbon, or other organic material like coconut shell, even, and wood-based carbons. So what they're doing is being forced into this activated carbon to then react and be held on the surface of each one of those active sites. And so there's a finite number of active sites, though, right? Which is why you can have predictive lifetimes of these carbon filters. And so that's the first one, would be physical adsorption. The second one would be for the capture of things like ammonia. It would be for the capture of hydrogen sulfide. It would be things like that that would be, again, have a lower boiling point, a lower molecular weight, and or a higher vapor pressure. And you have to chemically react with those. So those active sites then, instead of being open and ready to receive these chemical contaminants, for all intents and purposes, they're actually, it's a little more complicated than this, but they're filled, that those active sites are filled with a chemical that will react with that target chemical you're trying to address. So if you have a strong acid, you'd put a strong base on the surface of that media to neutralize it, right? So if you have hydrogen sulfide, you would put something like potassium hydroxide on there to be able to essentially render it neutralized.
So what you're saying is you've got a carbon filter or some kind of a physical surface, and it's what you coat the filter with, or the liquid, shall I say, that's in the in the filter, and that's what's stopping the really tiny molecular contaminants.
Absolutely, yeah. And there's different, there's different types of, when you talk about chemical substrates, then you can use like a activated alumina type substrate, and what we call it is actually whether it's activated carbon or activated alumina, or different types of base substrates, we call that impregnating the media. And so what actually happens is that for example, because what you want to do is you want to get the most complete impregnation of that media, so that you can, because this media is extremely porous, right? So if the molecule progresses through, it goes past, okay, that active site's taken up, as it progresses through the filter, you want to make sure that you have as much time for it to react with those different active sites, so that you can have a higher removal efficiency. Again, I'm really simplifying a lot of this, but that's kind of when you think about it, just think about that pegboard. Pegboard's either empty and ready to receive heavy, slow molecules, or it's filled with a chemical to react with a targeted chemical that's tough to capture.
For some reason, I get the feeling that the molecular are more complicated or don't last as long. How do they compare with carbon filters? How often would you have to change them? I know that depends, but give me an idea.
Yeah, no, and actually, I thought you were going to say to particulate filters. A molecular filter most likely will not last as long as a particulate filter. Okay. But, to say a carbon filter versus, I guess, how do I answer that? It does depend, right? Let's say that many times you're not going to need, I need a filter just for hydrogen sulfide. You may need a filter that's also going to address ozone, right? You also may need a filter that's going to address toluene or benzene, or, one of the other 99% of those 252 million chemicals out there, right? And so that's what you need, physical adsorption and chemical adsorption in the same filter. So is that what you're asking? Do physical adsorptive medias and chemical adsorptive medias, do they expire at different times? Is that what you're asking?
That's kind of, yes.
Okay. Okay. And they would. And so unfortunately, most times when people say, hey, I want to address as much of this stuff as possible coming in from outside air. Okay, fine. And what they'll do is they'll take a chemical impregnated media and they'll take a physical adsorptive media like carbon and blend it together in one unit. And while that sounds great, when it passes through in a single pass from outside air, you only have one chance to capture it. So you've dedicated 50% of your filter to a media that's only going to react with less than 1% of those outside air contaminants, right?
So what's the solution?
So the solution, the best solution, and again, I'm not saying I have no problem with blending the medias. An advantage would be it takes up less space, less initial cost. But the best solution would be you take a physical absorptive media and a chemical absorptive media, and you layer them, right? So you'd have a stage of physical absorptive media, a stage of chemical absorptive media, and then that way you can test them individually and see what the remaining lifetime is of each of those. And so you're not wasting any of that media. You're not wasting your money. So from an initial cost, yeah, blending them together in a single stage to address, you know, whatever you want to remove sounds like a good idea, right? But from a total cost of ownership perspective, it's always better to have two stages if you can afford the space.
Going from tiny molecular scale to these filters, how big an operation can they work in? What kind of scale can the filter solutions be deployed in?
Sure. So the way that they're, it could be anything from, like, let's say, again, let's start with things that people can understand, right? Let's start with something that we can actually wrap our minds around to start with. Schools, offices. So you'd use what we call an embedded media filter. So it could look just like a filter that's actually in your HVAC unit at home, right? Just something you'd buy at the hardware store. And what there's actually inside of that is embedded molecular media, most cases activated carbon, that would be able to provide you okay removal efficiency for like concentrations of gases in your home. So then we also have more advanced embedded media filters for the healthcare industry, right? That would be a combination of PM of PM1 filtration and embedded molecular media to be able to address things like ozone at over 90% removal efficiency. So that's kind of a compact one that you could put in just for general HVAC commercial air application. Then you would move into what we would consider a, you know, light process, for example, to heavy industrial. Light process could be something like in vitro fertilization, where you would want to have more targeted molecular contamination control. And so you would take a shell. For example, you know, it could be a box, it could be a cylinder, it could be a panel, it could be different configurations depending on the space that you have, and your budget and the removal efficiencies that you want to maintain. And you fill those different casings with particular molecular medias to be able to address the contaminants that you want to address. So, you know, this could be for general manufacturing. Labs, for example, have very specific, you know, you'd be looking at a couple different types of gases that they'd want to remove. And then even corrosion control, for example, like a refinery, they have these motor control centers, right? The control room, the brains of the entire operation of a refinery. They want to protect that from the printed circuit boards and the computers getting corroded. And so you would have a more industrial solution. So you can have something that could be several thousand pounds of media. So I would say from progressing in what we just talked about, think about it I should probably speak in kilograms as well. But so think about it in terms of five kilograms.
Okay.
You know, for the small scale, you know, in a one single opening.
That's about 10 pounds, I think, 50, is it?
Yeah, about 10 pounds. Yeah. Yep. To let's call it 50 kg for a light process solution. You know, it could be, you know, in the hundreds of, in the hundreds of pounds. And then finally, you would have 500 kg or more for thousands of pounds of media in a solution. So a big box that you would put, you know, because let's say you've got a polyurethane foam manufacturer, right? You know, foam mattresses, for example, they put out a lot of contaminants. Mm. And so for protecting the environment and those people around them, they have to put large industrial scrubbers out there to be able to have high removal efficiencies for a long period of time.
So it can be done on a big scale. How do you know if the solution is working?
Sure. Yeah, good question. You do air sampling, obviously, upstream and or downstream. That's going to, yeah, and there's real-time monitors for that are out there. You can also, we have, you know, Camfil ourselves have, even before you purchase a solution, there's the ability to be able to use simulation software to be able to look at different adsorption theories and really look at the concentrations of the gases and understand how they, you know, the contact time meaning how long the, you know, when you look at the velocity of the air passing through that design you've made, whether it be through hundreds of pounds of media, thousands of pounds of media, you know, how long it's going to be in contact to be able to see what the initial lifetime would be. But then nothing's as good as taking a sample of your media, sending it back to the manufacturer which you purchased it from, and letting them sample the media to be able to see what the remaining life is. So you'll be able, what essentially what they're doing is seeing how many more, you know, how many of those peg holes do you have left that are open is what you're looking for. So you would have to do that with media sampling. And there's different types of, obviously, with the different types of media, there's different types of media sampling that has to take place.
And that gives you a much better idea then of when you should change the filters.
100%. Yep.
Trent, you make all of this sound absolutely amazing, and you've explained it so well, and I understand it. And thank you so very much for joining us on the podcast today. If you'd like to find out more about this, just follow the links in the show notes. You'll find them in the description of the podcast on your phone or whichever device you're listening to us on. They include links and contact details for Trent and anything else that you might need to get more information. Our podcast today was produced by Camfil, a world leader in the development of production of air filters and clean air solutions. To stay up to date on how clean air can affect the quality process for you and your workplace, do click follow so that you get our next podcast automatically on your phone or whatever you're listening to us on. Until next time, from myself, Dusty Rhodes, thank you so much for listening and take care.